All right, Deuteronomy chapter 16. Let's read. Tell you what. Let's read 1 through 8, and then we'll have somebody read 9 through 12, and then 13 through 17. We'll just go ahead and get these, but break the reading up, because they kind of all are going to go together when we begin to talk about them. So Deuteronomy 16, 1 through 8. Who'll grab that, Ron?
Observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God, for in the month of Abib the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. Therefore, you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and from the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. You shall eat no leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread with it, that is the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that you may remember the day in which you came out of the land of Egypt all the days of your life. And no leaven shall be seen among you in all your territory for 7 days, nor shall any of the meat which you sacrifice the first day at twilight remain overnight until morning. You may not sacrifice the Passover within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you, but at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide, there you shall sacrifice the Passover at twilight, at the going down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt. And you shall roast and eat it in the place which the Lord your God chooses. And in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a sacred assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work on it.
And 9 through 12, who'll grab that, Elijah?
You shall count 7 weeks for yourself. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the grain. Then you shall keep the feast of the weeks to the Lord your God with the tribute of a freewill offering from your hand, which you shall give as the Lord your God blesses you. You shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, and your female servant, the Levite who is within your gates, the stranger and the fatherless, and the widow who are among you, at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. And you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and that you shall be careful to observe all these statutes.
And 13 to 17. Philip?
You shall observe the Feast of the Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, and the Levite, the stranger and the fatherless, and the widow who are within your gates. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Tabernacles. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty handed. Every man shall give as he is able according to the blessing of the Lord your God which he has given.
Okay, so as it wraps up there, those last two verses tell us that these are three of the feasts that God had prescribed that when they get into the land of Canaan, they were to go to a central location to observe these feasts. And they weren't free to observe them wherever they wanted to. They could not do that in their hometown, at their home, at their land, wherever they may be. But they had to travel and go down to the central location. Of course, eventually that ends up being Jerusalem with the temple being built there. And that's where they observe those things. But what are these three feasts? Question one, I ask, note the three feasts and a few key points about each one. So what are they, first of all? You may have even little subheadings in there. Okay, the Passover, which is tied with what? Yeah, Feast of Unleavened Bread. They went together. The Passover was the day before the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And quite often in the Bible, they're interchangeable. When it talks about the Passover, it also includes unleavened bread. Talks about Feast of Unleavened Bread, it's also including the Passover, just because they were tied together right there. What's the next feast that he talks about? Feast of Weeks, which is also what? Pentecost, right? Because it talks about the seven Sabbaths and then the day after, which is the Pentecost, which, by the way, in Acts chapter 2, that's where it gets to. The day of Pentecost has fully come. That means it was Sunday morning when those events unfolded in Acts 2. So there's that. And then the last one, of course, Feast of Tabernacles. What are each one of these for? Passover and unleavened bread. What's that associated with? What's he telling them you need to think about? Remember. Yeah, when you're freed from Egypt. And it goes back to they were to take all the leaven out. They offered the sacrificial lamb, the paschal lamb, Passover lamb. The angel of death passed over. So that was to commemorate that occasion, them being delivered by that 10th plague. And then the Pentecost, Feast of Harvest or Feast of Weeks. What's that about? Sort of just gave it away, but. Yeah, harvest. The ingathering. They've got their first fruits that are coming in. And they're to think about the bountiful blessings of God. And then what about the tabernacles? What's it also called, by the way? It's just another word for tabernacle. Yeah, Feast of Booths. And what do they do then? Yeah, we read booth, but really what is it? Yeah, it's a little tent, little shack type thing that they would build, they would set up out there, and they would celebrate this feast. And what was it in commemoration of?
Harvest.
Well, the harvest is Feast of Weeks.
It was to remember that God looked out there in the wilderness.
Yeah, the main thing is that they're to remember about the time they were traveling, that God looked out for them and God provided for them in that wilderness. So you've got all those feasts there. Are there any parallels in the New Testament?
We've got Pentecost, of course. Feast of Weeks, but that specific one that they have, anyone can come to it, any nation can come to it, which is what kind of makes it very special.
Well, the Jews came in, devout Jews from under every nation under heaven came and gathered for that. And then they spoke the languages and it amazed the people. It reinforced this is God at work here. You've got the Passover, which the closest thing to it in the New Testament, obviously what? Yeah, Lord's Supper, because that's the night the Lord instituted the Lord's Supper. Take the unleavened bread, take the fruit of the vine, remember my body, remember my blood. And so it's remembering that sacrifice that opened the door for delivery, just like the Passover in Egypt opened that door for them to leave slavery. The sacrifice of Christ, the Lamb of God, opened that door for us to leave the slavery of sin. What about Pentecost? What was it? Mike referenced it a minute ago, but where's the tie-in? What happened there in Acts 2 on that day of Pentecost?
The speaking in tongues of the sermon so everybody could hear and understand. You had baptism, about 3,000 souls.
Okay, you have the 3,000, you have a great harvest beginning to come in, the beginning of the harvest of souls. in the gospel of Jesus Christ. So that's the connection there. That's obviously why the Lord chose Pentecost to do that. Well, you have the practical thing of all the people gathered there. You have an audience there. But it's also playing on that imagery of that history of the purpose and the point of that feast, just like him establishing the Lord's Supper. What about tabernacles? Anything in the New Testament you think of that might touch on at least the meaning or the purpose or the idea?
I think you just brought up the idea that this is a permanent kind of journey to something better, to go to the promised land.
Okay, we're strangers and pilgrims, just like they were wandering. We're wandering in our wilderness right now. And the Lord tells us in Matthew chapter 6, we need to trust in the Lord just as they needed to trust in the Lord when they were in the wilderness and they were unsettled and going through difficult areas, that we need to trust in the Lord as we're going through this life. You know, seek first the kingdom of God and what will happen? All these things will be added to you. He'll look out for you. We need to be ever mindful that the Lord is looking out for us and providing us. And any other thoughts there on those three feasts?
Zach. Paul mentions the idea of cleaning out the yoke of leaven in 1 Corinthians 5, trying to deal with division and specific sins that the church was not addressing. Mm-hmm. And he talks about leaven and that Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed.
Exactly. Yeah, with him being our Passover, we got to get rid of that leaven of sin. It doesn't belong in the church. It can't be in there. Nancy.
Something I had not actually noticed, though I've probably read it a lot of times, is that in this reference, it refers to the unleavened bread as the bread of affliction. And we know that bread represents Christ's body. And that was just striking.
Right, bread of affliction. And remember originally when they made it, and part of that Passover observance, they eat it with what kind of herbs?
Bitter herbs.
Bitter herbs. You see that reasoning. It's in the Old Covenant, of course, there were physical material things that were to reinforce spiritual lessons for them. And so this reference on the bread of affliction is one of those things to reinforce. There is sacrifice, there is suffering associated with it, but it's leading to something better. So again, it says every male is to appear there where the Lord designates, and they are not to come empty handed. The New American Commentary says regarding this, it's kind of like them coming to these feasts and they're renewing a pledge of loyalty to the Lord. They're rededicating themselves to him, of course, and drawing close to him. And you've got the males, it says, who are responsible for this. It's their duty, their job. They are the spiritual leaders. They are to be actively engaged in this, and everyone must come. All the males were required to come. So question number two, we'll just briefly touch on this. Can you find where any of these feasts were observed in the New Testament? Because we mentioned Pentecost. Go ahead.
Well, Matthew 26 and the other gospel accounts of the institution of the Lord's Supper. What they were observing at that time was the Passover.
Yes. And it's interesting in the book of John that the Passover is mentioned three times, and that's how we measure the Lord's ministry. That we figure three and a half years because it mentions three different Passovers, and just sort of putting the pieces together, you understand that's the time frame that we have of him working with his disciples, preparing them for their mission once he would ascend back to heaven. So we've got the Passover there, we've got the Pentecost we mentioned in Acts 2. You read a couple places where Paul was hurrying to make the feast of the Passover and things, or the Pentecost, things like that. Anybody remember the Feast of Tabernacles? Did you get a reference on that?
John 7.
Yeah, John 7. It's just interesting that all these are mentioned, and all of them you have the Lord at some point or another, of course, that he would observe them and participate in them. And the disciples did, at least in the gospel accounts for sure, because they were under that system, because they lived under that system. Now, the same thing would be true for the Sabbath. They observed the Sabbath. It's because they were under that system. But once the gospel was established, they were not required to observe any of these things. That they didn't observe the Sabbath as a matter of the law. They didn't observe any of the other feasts as a matter of the law. We're not under obligation to keep them is the point. There are people today who say, we have to keep the Sabbath. Well, if we have to keep the Sabbath, we also have to keep all these feasts. And if we have to keep all these feasts, what do we have to do? What's that? Yeah, really, you have to keep the whole law. But in this chapter here, what does he close up with? Bring the sacrifice. We got to go to Jerusalem. Right? I mean, we've got to go. All the males are supposed to go to one place. So it just helps to highlight the absurdity of saying we go back and keep the old law. We don't. We're not under any obligation for that. All right, let's press on because I want to spend the rest of our time with chapter 16, verse 18 down through the 17. And just notice what's being talked about here. Very important things. Let's read 16, 18 to 22 to start with. Who will get that for us? 16, 18 to 22. Logan, you want to get that?
You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God has given you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge you the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God has given you. You shall not plant for yourself an asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. You shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar which the Lord your God hates.
Okay, so first thing he says, verse 18, is you go in and you do what? And why?
Judges.
You appoint judges. So they can judge the people. Where are they to be appointed?
Towns.
Yeah. Towns, all your gates. So throughout the country, you're to have this. He's setting up a judicial system for them to operate on. Yeah, they're going to be distributed among the tribes there. And what does he admonish these judges to do? What is supposed to be their mode of operating, if you will? Okay, impartial. Why might they be partial?
Well, because it could be related to a lot of these people.
Okay, right. Could be related to them. Cousin Joe or, you know, your son or your daughter or your parents or somebody, your close friend, could be these people. You got to be careful. Don't be partial in these judgments. What's another thing that's going to corrupt the justice?
Making sure you're not taking gifts, bribes.
Taking bribes, right? There is a problem that is persistent pretty much in any society that wealth sometimes blinds justice. Celebrity can blind justice at times. Different things that pull the wool over people's eyes, and there's just nothing done about that because of the wealth, the money, the celebrity, the fame, the power maybe that an individual has. And so he's saying you cannot have that among your people. You're going to possess the land by the justness that exists in that land. And if you pervert it, the idea is you're going to end up losing that. So in 21 and 22, what does he say? Don't do it. Yeah. Don't make any wooden images. It's another reminder, and he's fitting it in here in this thing of justice. You cannot be setting up these idolatrous images or idolatrous pillars. You can't have any of that. That is not your system. That is not the way you live. Those are not the things that you are to give your devotion or allegiance to. All right, so 17, let's read 1 through 7 here. Deuteronomy 17, 1 through 7. Ron.
You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God a bull or sheep which has any blemish or defect, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God. If there is found among you within any of your gates which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord your God and transgressing his covenant, who has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, either the sun or the moon or any of the host of heaven, which I have commanded, and it is told you, and you hear of it, then you shall inquire diligently. And if it is indeed true and certain that such an abomination has been committed in Israel, then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has committed that wicked thing, and shall stone to death that man or woman with stones. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. So you shall put away the evil from among you.
Okay, so question number one, or question three rather, in verse one, what's the underlying principle of the command? You'll not sacrifice bull or sheep which has any blemish or defect.
Pure.
Pure?
You
can only offer your best. Right. The Lord deserves the best that we have. Not the defective, not the leftover, not the broken down. God deserves the very best that we have.
And we had the best sacrifice through Christ, who was pure and sinless.
Yes. All of this is pointing toward that perfect, pure sacrifice in Christ. The pulpit commentary made note, or rather the expositor's Bible commentary made note, that the quality of the sacrifice reflects the esteem of the worshiper. So what we offer to God reflects what we think about God. That flows through every area of our life, and especially when we come in the presence of God, it reflects what we think about Him. So we have to be mindful of that. That's a principle that's laid out here. So any other thoughts on verse 1 there? So he says, don't make any wooden image. And when you come before God, offer your very best. You can't offer anything with the blemish or a defect in it. And then what does he bring up? Verses 2 to 7.
So he's reminding them that that's not what you're supposed to do now. That's not what dictates your world and your life.
So right.
Bless you.
Yeah, they don't get caught up in this idolatry of worshiping these images, these things in nature here. So he says you need to have judges that will judge the people. And he says, don't have idolatry and don't offer me corrupt worship. And now he's getting into, when somebody violates this, here's what you do. This is what's supposed to take place. They get caught up in idolatry, and what do you do to them? Stone them. So it says somebody reports idolatry. What's the first thing they're to do?
Investigate.
Investigate, right? Have y'all ever heard a rumor that wasn't true? Okay, this past, oh, I can't even remember when it was. But anyways, so we've been here a little over a year now. Sometime in the past year, okay, my mom told me, oh, somebody that she talked to said that the governor's going to close the borders to North Carolina, and so we better not leave on a going out of town trip because we won't be able to get back in. And I immediately was like, that's crazy. There's no way they could ever do that. It's just not possible. But, you know, these crazy things get started, and there are people who get caught up in it, and they repeat it, and they repeat, you know. Don't tell my mom I said that. But, you know, there are things that you could imagine. There would be reports that would go out. And he's saying here, don't just believe everything you hear. You need to investigate, find out, get the facts, and determine whether or not it's so. And if it is so, then that is wickedness. That is sin. And you take them and you stone them to death. And what are the stipulations around somebody being stoned to death? Have to have two or three witnesses at least. Can't just do it on the testimony of one. You could imagine revenge taking place in those situations. Philip?
The witnesses are the ones that basically pass the first stone. That's the ones that have to start.
Right.
Lay hands on them first.
And why would he make that stipulation? Why would God put that in there?
Better be telling the truth,
right? Because you're the one that's going to have to act on this. You have to do it. It's one thing to want somebody stoned to death. It's another thing that you're the one who initiates that. So it's a measure of safety, if you will. Mike?
When you think about the trial of Jesus also, they didn't want his blood on their hands. You see that much.
Right, and imagine them wrongly accusing someone, stoning them to death, and then the next day, or a year later, or 5 years later, 10 years, it's just going to just eat away at them, what they've done. So, yeah, it's a measure of safety that's being put in there. And he says, you do this, the very last part of verse 7, for what purpose, to what end? Get rid of the wickedness. Remove evil from among you. You need to keep the congregation pure.
I was going to mention that very thing, Stephen, that as he's describing the sacrifices in their conduct, in their behavior, what God is telling them, that anything less than that is an abomination to him. It's distasteful to him. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, God is holy, and therefore we are to be.
Exactly, exactly. We're to reflect that esteem and respect that we have for God in our actions. And he's carrying it out here that, you know, if that's going on, you've got to get rid of that among you. So question number 4, I had asked, does the death penalty devalue life? Why or why not?
No, I think it upholds it. Because it imparts the seriousness.
Right. The death penalty originally in Genesis chapter 9 was instituted because of the value of human life. There is no death penalty in the Bible for killing an animal. You repay somebody, but you're not put to death. There is the death penalty when you wrongly kill another human being. It's because they're made in the image of God. And it's showing there is value in that life above every other life that exists in this universe. And so it upholds the value of life. And it flows through here in this and saying, look, God demands that you as his people honor him and worship him. And if you don't, as his people, you're to be stoned to death. That's in the nation of Israel. Now today, what happens to people who are among God's people but turn to idolatry? What happens with them? They're withdrawn from. Okay, they spiritually die, right? They're cut off from God, but then they're withdrawn from, they're removed from out of the congregation. Get rid of that evil from among you. As Zach was mentioning a while ago in 1 Corinthians 5, he particularly talks about, you know, you purge out that old leaven. You get rid of that out of the congregation so it doesn't corrupt everyone else. All right, so let's read verses 8 through 13. Deuteronomy 17, 8 through 13. Who will get that for us? Philip. So what's this section covering?
Just like the hierarchy of the judicial system that he's setting up. If it's too hard of a case to figure out, then you send it on up to the priests.
Okay, yeah, the priest presumably having what advantage? Okay, maybe closer to God, the ear of God, the high priest in particular maybe. Anything else?
Knowledge of the law. Specific knowledge of the law.
They should really know the law and then how to apply that. If there is some type of question or uncertainty among these people, you could imagine in some of these towns and villages or whatever that at times the people are just not going to have the kind of knowledge of the law that they really need in a particular case. And so they've got to take it on up, if you will, that system in order to make sure that the right thing is done. Now, when he says that the Levites or the priests, they give that judgment, what happens? What does he tell them they must do?
You must follow what they've said.
You got to do what they tell you to do.
Yes.
So, I don't know, maybe sometimes they're a little reluctant because they see where it's going. They're like, let's take this on up. Well, you got to do it. Verse 12, though.
I had something else I was going to ask.
Yeah, go ahead.
The high priest had the Urim and the Thummim.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't that to give them the means of judgment, as we understand, as it was first described to Aaron? And so the high priest was to wear the breastplate that contained the Urim and the Thummim.
Yes.
So as you're saying, as they continue to elevate this, it reaches that point.
Right, yeah, like Philip said, they've got that ear of God, so to speak. They use those to make a judgment when it just gets too hard for them. They would use that. And don't ask me how that all worked. I just know what it says. But yes, exactly right. And so it gets up there. They make that judgment. You need to follow through with it. But verse 12. Yeah, somebody who acts presumptuously will not heed the priest, that man's to be executed. How serious is he about following the law?
Dead.
Deadly serious. Yeah, exactly right. All right, Let's read 14 to 20, and I'm hurrying because I want to get to something at the end here. 14 to 20, who will read that for us? Go ahead, Jesse.
When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause his people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way ever again. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests, the Levites. Excuse me. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand nor to the left, and that he may prolong his days in the kingdom, he and his children.
Okay, so he's anticipating the time that they're going to have kings. If you back up to promises made to Abraham, one of the promises is, from you will come kings. And then you go forward a little bit to Judah when Jacob or Israel is blessing his sons. He says of Judah that the scepter will not depart from Shiloh, you know, or scepter will not depart from Judah until a Shiloh come. Well, a scepter is referring to a king and a ruler, right? So God always knew they were going to have a king. Here he's telling them, you're going to have a king and you're going to ask one because you're going to look at all these other nations. He's not approving of it. And when you get into 1 Samuel, as the question 5 deals with, that they do ask for a king because they wanted to be like all the other nations. So they had the wrong intent. They were rejecting God. They weren't asking for a king because they wanted someone to lead them in doing God's will and living God's way, to be that example, to enforce the law. They weren't asking for that. They were asking for a king because they thought, well, we want to be like everybody else around us. So wrong motive there, but what's the stipulation that he puts on this? And we'll just jump to question 6. List the rules God gave to govern kings and which one stands out above all others if you saw one that stood out.
Well, actually two of them to me stand out. The most important one is that he reads the Bible, that he studies the law every day so he can administer justice and keep people humble.
Got to study the law.
Yeah.
Okay.
The second one, in my personal opinion, mm-hmm.
Okay, and if you look back to Joe's point, had to be from their brethren. It could not be a foreigner. If you go back in history, it's pretty frequent that foreigners ruled as kings over a different people. In fact, there's a pretty strong indication that during Jacob's time, or rather Joseph's time in Egypt, there was a foreign king actually serving as the Pharaoh. And then when the Egyptians took over, that's when the problems came and they oppressed the children of Israel, things like that. They were afraid another person would come from the outside and take them over. The Ptolemies were Greek. They weren't Egyptians. When you look at all kinds of different nations in Europe that they... all those kings were basically cousins, you know, for a while to each other. I think today maybe a lot of them are still, you know, blood related, essentially a family or two ruling all of Europe. And that's not their native country. And so, yeah, there's a very important principle in there. Any other thoughts there?
Well,
Philip.
Not only did he have to study the law, he had to write his own copy.
Had to make his own copy. How well would you learn the law if you're writing that out, right? And let's understand, when he's saying write out this law, it's really not a reference to, he needs to copy all of Genesis down, he needs to copy, but the law, when you get, you know, to Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy perhaps even, but that's the things you're to write out, those things, so he would know this. Nancy. Right. He had to live it out in his life.
Well, also, he had to copy it in the presence of the priests. So, to make sure that he had it right.
Yeah, they would not so want a corrupt copy.
Oh, I'll just jot this down.
Right. Well, I don't like that one, so I'm going to change it up. Yeah. Could not do that. He had to write that down correctly and live by it. All right. Any other thoughts there?
Yeah, Solomon is, I think, would be the best example of a guy that is so wise and so gifted from God with wisdom. And yet, the warning that God puts here about the horses, the wives, he didn't heed. And then it come back to, ended up, ultimately, I don't know about ultimately, but I know certainly he fell away.
Right. Okay, I'm going to give you my theory real quick, and then I'm going to wrap this up on something I want us to think about. My firm conviction is Solomon repented, because he's got, is it three books in the Bible? I just don't see God having a guy put three books in the Bible who, in the end, lost his soul. So that's my theory, for what it's worth. All right, very good. So, thinking about this, it says he is to fear the Lord and be careful to observe it. So he's to copy the law, he's to read that law, he is to fear the Lord and observe it. What's the whole duty of man? Fear God and keep his commandments. That's built in right here, right? It says that's what the king must do. So they were going to ask for a king, but he says, you know, you're going to have a king, but God's going to pick the king, and here's what he must do. This is how he must live and behave. This is what should govern him as a man sitting on the throne. All right. So what I want to think about, I don't know if I want to, yeah, I want to write this down. Okay. So it just occurred to me going through this, foundations of a just and prosperous society. One of the first ones is law. Why would law be a foundation of a just and prosperous society? Because we have people in our nation trying to get rid of law. But why is law?
Law is a force to govern. The strength of the governing is found in the teeth of the law. If the law is not enforced, then there is no governance. There is no civility.
Yeah, there's no civility. There's a common standard by which society is to live. Clint.
So I was going to say, it's a standard. You know, an inch is an inch. A foot is a foot. Nobody has the right to say that my inch is better than yours.
Right, right. There are clear guidelines on what is and what is not acceptable. It's a shared agreement. It's a compact. We in our nation live under the compact of the Constitution. We've all agreed that that's the law that governs this land. Now, whether you have explicitly agreed to that or implicitly, if you're a citizen of this nation, that's what you've agreed to. You live in this nation. That's what you agree to. We have to have citizens that do what? Citizens that respect, right? The law. Because you can have a law, but if people don't respect it, what happens? They ignore it. It all falls apart. So we have to follow it personally. We have to help one another. be accountable. You think about what he's saying there. You hear about idolatry, you investigate it, you find out that that's going on. Your hand needs to be the first when they're put to death. So as a community, we hold each other accountable to that law. We don't just turn a blind eye when people are blatantly, flagrantly ignoring it and violating it. And if you will, a jury of our peers, right? I'm telling you that our nation is built on these principles that come from the Word of God. We help to enforce it. We're not to be suspicious of our neighbors, you know, always just spying on them, things like that. But we act when there's a clear violation. There has to be judges. Why do there have to be judges?
It's just as we completed reading that, you know, Philip was reading to us and discussing that there has to be a means of reaching a judgment, and by having judges who understand the law and are in a position to rule according to the law will set forth that level, and going up to, as we have, a Supreme Court.
Right.
We have local, you know, within societies, as we have within our cities, within our states, you know, within our federal.
Right. And you've got to know when it's being violated and then applying the appropriate penalty to that. The judges have to be what? That started out. They enforce.
They're supposed to be impartial.
Impartial, honest.
Yes.
Right? And I think we've all seen there are times when there are dishonest judges, and that wreaks havoc. All right, so you've got with these here, if you will. Well, I'll put this other one down. So I'm going to put leader instead of king. But you have to have leaders that are committed to the law. From among the citizens, right? And this isn't a U.S. lesson, but I mean, they put a provision in there. The president has to be natural born citizen, right? Where do they get that? The Word of God, right? It has to be from among you. Because that loyalty principle that Joe talked about a minute ago. And they're not to multiply horses. They're not to be power-hungry people. Not to be compromising, weak, and feckless, and abdicating their duty. He says, returning to Egypt. They can't compromise and just go back to Egypt. Like, this is too difficult. Let's just all go back to Egypt and return them there. He's to be a moral man, not governed by his fleshly passions. Don't multiply your wives. Not to be materialistic, multiplying gold and silver. He's to be studious and dedicated, knowing the law. He observes the law in fear of the Lord and acknowledges he is under what? What's the last part there about the king?
He's not supposed to consider himself to be above everybody else.
What do we call that? We call that something. Okay, there's humble. Rule of law, right? Now, you got all this in Israel. We see echoes or reflections of that in our nation. Where else does this apply?
Church.
Right? We have a law that we absolutely have to respect. And as citizens of the kingdom of God, we need to make sure that it's being followed, and we help hold each other accountable to that law. And in that sense, we sit as judges. You know, Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians, well, can't you just judge among yourselves? See, we do judge each other. I know people get really upset about that sometimes, but we judge each other. If there's a violation that's taking place, we need to address that. We shouldn't shy away from it. And we shouldn't show partiality and favoritism among our friends and family, but that we apply it righteously. And leaders among God's people, they need to know the will of God. They need to observe it in the fear of the Lord. All right, any other thoughts?
Well,
we're talking about law, isn't it like truth where it's not supposed to be ruled by our emotions, but it's supposed to be logic?
Yes. When we're talking about law in the New Testament sense, we're talking about truth.
Right.
Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. And that's to govern it, not my emotions, my feelings, my desires. Exactly. All right. Thank you all very much. Lord willing, we'll press on next week.